Hello and welcome to the second in our special editions of the Brewing Podcast. There can be no bigger issue in the world than the sourcing of energy. It determines our current rate of inflation, which is one of the biggest issues right at the moment, and it will determine our ability to live in harmony with the environment, which is obviously one of the biggest issues long term. So in this podcast, we're going to be digging into that topic with one of the top scholars in that field, Amy Myers Jaffa. But remember that this is not investment advice. We can't guarantee sources from outside Brew and Dolphin, and tax legislation and allowances can change. Please also remember that when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values can increase or decrease because of currency fluctuations, and future performance can differ from that of the past. And with that said, let's discuss the future of energy. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the Brewing Podcast. We are going to be discussing a topic which I think is going to be really, really important to us, really for the rest of our careers. It's, of course, the topic of energy and a multidimensional look at energy and the important role that it's going to play and how it's going to develop over the future. And we're going to take the opportunity to do that with Amy Myers Jaffa, who is an energy consultant and leading expert on the geopolitics of oil, energy and security. And she's an influential thought leader on global energy policy and sustainability, all really big, important topics. She's also the author of a fantastic book called Energy's Digital Future. And she is the research professor and MD of the Climate Policy Lab at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. So, Amy, thanks very much for joining us and welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here.
So, I mean, maybe we'll start actually with your book. I mean, it's intriguingly titled, of course, Energy's Digital Future. So what do you mean by those words?
Well, you know, digital, of course, means anything that's going to be sort of computer assistant, dealing with data and automation, artificial intelligence. And we're seeing those kind of technologies moving increasingly into the energy space, whether that's in solar industry, you're having smart inverters that can automatically island off a mini grid from the grid if it checks there's too much voltage movement from an outage. Or, you know, we're starting to get to automobiles or trucks that can drive themselves. You know, new thermostats that you can program to try to tap excess renewable energy in the middle of the day from solar or late in the evening for wind. So we're talking about a whole class of inventions. And I even throw in 3D printing, which people don't really understand much, but is used very widely in the aerospace industry. So that's where I have a digital design for creating a widget, in this case, maybe a jet engine, and I literally print it from scratch using powders and metals, powdered metals and other kind of plastics, which means that I don't have to be shipping all kinds of components when I go to build something like an airplane or other kinds of heavy material. And of course, a lot of the oil that we use in the world, a lot of it is used in transportation of goods. So the shifty 3D printing could actually be very impactful.
So this is a story or a vision in which there's a different kind of fuel and energy required in the future.
Absolutely. I mean, my feeling is the sort of digital age, the sort of computerization, Internet of Things, is really going to enable renewable energy. We're seeing here in the United States, we're seeing a very wide deployment of batteries for storage for electricity and new applications where small scale batteries. So not just I'm putting a battery on top of a wind farm to get me a couple of hours of storage, but you know, in a household and its function in many different ways in a household setting or in a business setting. So all of those inventions are really going to change the kind of fuels we can use and the cost of what those fuels are, give us more resilience when we're in a heat wave or other kind of severe weather. And so it's really sort of like you know, a view into the future of what the energy system might look like, the more robotic and AI and big data we're able to use.
And so do you think that we are close then to solving the storage problem that really will enable much greater use of renewables? Because obviously they have this challenge of intermittency.
I do think we're very close in a variety of different ways. So there's one solution we call virtual power plant, where I have small batteries in individual homes or apartments or in offices and businesses. And then the utility is able to either through a vendor or itself to aggregate the excess capacity of each small battery to use to provide more stability to the system when there's intermittency. So imagine in Western Australia, they've tried this where all the renewable energy is stored in these, you know, hundreds of small batteries. And then at a time when it's not windy or at a time when there's a heat wave, you deploy all at once the excess capacity in these hundreds of small batteries. So that's one thing we're seeing already today in New York City and other locations are starting to view that favorably as an option to relieve congestion on a grid. But then we have, you know, other things coming. There's something called an air iron battery that, I mean, to be unscientific, kind of uses the chemistry of rusting to create electricity storage in a more stationary battery. They tend to be heavier today. But if you're using that at a wind farm or at a utility scale solar farm, still pretty useful for days or weeks of storage. And so therefore getting away from the fact that I can only use it for a short period of time. And we're getting more sophisticated in how we use pumped air storage or pump water storage. You know, in the old days, you know, you would pump the water up a hill and then run it down a hill to be sort of a storage for electricity, but we're getting more sophisticated plants. And then long term, and I do think that the crisis in Europe is really maybe accelerating this forward, we know that we're going to be able to use electrolyzers to produce hydrogen from deep offshore wind or from large solar units or geothermal and other kinds of energy supply. And that hydrogen can be stored for months. So it could be a solution for, you know, winter time when renewables aren't as effective, say, in the Northern Hemisphere. So we're seeing a lot of solutions come to market, and there's a lot of investor interest. If you, you know, look at the list of SPACs that have been formed in the last year, a lot of them are in this space of batteries or charging stations or other kinds of, you know, automated vehicles. You know, you're finding that electric vehicles, you know, in that SPAC space. And I do think a lot of investment managers are looking carefully at which of those have the most promise and could be part of the portfolio.
And do you see nuclear as being a part of that, or is that an unnecessary risk if the problem of intermittency of renewables can be solved?
Well, you know, in the United States, the Biden administration has absolutely emphasize the integration of small modular reactors with renewables. It's integrated energy solutions. It sounds very innocuous, but then you find out that underneath the out of it is some small nuclear plant. But the U.S. military is looking at that even in a place like Alaska. So in the highly contested nuclear market in South Africa, where you had Russia and China and the United States all bidding against each other for South Africa's very promising market. It is a small nuclear reactor solution from an American company that is currently sort of in the money for developing that capacity in South Africa. So I do think we're going to see, we call them the nickname SMRs. I do think we're going to see SMRs going forward. And again, with the whole crisis situation in Europe, how countries think about nuclear and how to advance nuclear, I think is going to be a piece of the puzzle. It's going to be very hard. Not every country, you know, nuclear is not accepted in every population, but I do think it's a big part of the mix in places like India and China. And I do think small nuclear reactors are starting to have a little bit of a potential. You're even seeing Bill Gates move into that space.
What is it that's so special about small modular reactors compared to our previous experience with nuclear?
Well, the first one, of course, is cost control, because I can have a smaller size and I can manufacture it in a standardized way that lowers costs. Then I can add to a site, so I can start out with one or two modules and have add modules over time. And then it's just particularly, I think the new designs are safer. And so the proliferation risk and the accident risk is considered to be more desirable. So across all the different features, it's considered a good solution. And then also it's how technically it can be paired with renewables in specific fashion. There's one company that's has a solution that you use spent fuel rods as the fuel for that reactor. And therefore it has a sort of a cleanup element where you could create steam from cleaning up nuclear waste, and therefore use that steam as a backup and a heat solution or even electricity solution to back up renewables.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Obviously, the big concern that people have, or one of the big concerns people have with nuclear, is what to do with the waste. And we're, I think, suffering from a decommissioning project in the UK, which will outlive any of us. Have solutions been found, or is there a consensus on what you do with nuclear waste in a new nuclear future?
Well, no, I don't think we're facing a major solution to that. Some of the solutions, of course, are subpar, and I think that the risks are still high. And so, research on these technologies, either that it's some kind of reactor design where that burn rate is higher, and so therefore there's less waste, or these very advanced designs that haven't been built yet but might be demonstrated in the United States, where you can actually use the nuclear waste as your part of your fuel cycle. Those two things, I think, are important to the nuclear future.
You mentioned the crisis in Europe a few moments ago, and I suppose one of the things that has always been the case is that foreign policy and energy policy have been sort of inextricably linked. I wonder how you think the movement away from hydrocarbons might change our relations with some of the different regimes around the world.
You know, you mentioned my current book, but I have a historical book called Oil, Dollars, Debt, and Crises. And one of the theses of that book is that there's an endogenous cycle of geopolitical risk, war, and the volatility in oil prices that goes together, and it's almost self-fulfilling, or is in maybe perhaps self-fulfilling. And so I think that if you think about how many times we've seen a paired oil price shock come across the global economy, and then found some kind of a financial crisis that was associated with that shock, and the concerns about the pairing of those two things. Each time that it's happened, it's convinced governments to put more policies in place, whether that's research and development policies or whether that's actual deployment policies, to move the needle faster on alternative energy. And I think we're getting to the point in today's innovation age where, with computerization and digitization, you know, innovation can take place a lot faster than it used to with all this computing power. I do think, since we're having an oil price shock this 2 minutes, and as that shock ripples through the system, whether it lasts for another couple of days or whether it lasts longer, you know, the point is, after we go through these shock events, We get to have more focused policies that do propel alternative fuels. And we're already seeing that in the acceleration of countries' targets for renewable energy. And I think we'll see more of that going forward, where the sort of impetus behind the global climate meetings, combined with the fact that more and more countries are concerned about energy security. Of course, you know, there's the return to coal in some places, but in many other places, I think you're going to see a larger push into renewables and other kinds of alternative fuels that are not hydrocarbon based.
In a world in which which energy is more reliant upon either nuclear or renewables, will Western countries need a whole new set of energy allies?
Well, I mean, you know, now there's a whole lot of discussion about where are these metals going to come from that are part of the new economy. You know, people talk about the timelines for things as if they're somehow, it's very fast in oil and gas and very slow in renewables. And that's not quite accurate. I mean, the amount of time it takes to develop a new lithium mine is probably completely indistinguishable from the amount of time it takes to develop a deep water offshore oil or gas development or some giant LNG project someplace. And so I just think it's a question of governments and businesses making commitments. We're seeing more and more net zero announcements and net zero commitments. And those things are bringing about new sources of investment, not only in metals and mining and metals processing and, you know, electric vehicle plants and so forth and manufacturing, battery manufacturing. But also, you know, you're seeing the traditional players like Saudi Arabia investing heavily now in trying to build a hydrogen business. You're seeing the EU talking to North African countries and other African countries about a hydrogen network. And so I do think there's just a lot of potential. And you know, the relationship between nations influences that, in terms of how people see what countries they want to increase trade with and not increase trade with, and how that fits into the puzzle of future manufacturing for clean tech, as well as the raw materials that are required.
Do you think the stated objective of so many countries to be net zero, do you think that changes the way that OPEC tries to set its policy, that it's no longer sort of trying to maintain oil's place at the heart of the energy ecosystem, but is perhaps more inclined now to just make sure it can maximize the revenue from the remaining oil years?
You know, it's hard to say. How do we separate out certain OPEC countries' desire for higher revenues right this minute to solve immediate budgetary problems and the long-term view of what the pace of eliminating oil demand is going to look like over time? You know, if you talk to officials from many of these governments, they're very skeptical that we can move away from oil at all. And so, you know, one would imagine that they would want to have lower prices to ensure market share. So one of the things that I think is going on, you know, in the current market is that in 2020, when we had the COVID lockdowns, very impactful on oil demand, there was actually like a containment problem. Countries were producing oil and there wasn't enough storage space inside their country or in their shipment networks to provide for more oil production. And so you got drilling cutbacks, investment cutbacks in 2020. And then, of course, we had a very strong global recovery in 2021. And that caused a shortage that, you know, created this opportunity to promote high oil prices. And I think the next pivotal stage is going to be, what does each individual country decide what's in its interests, right? Will we see countries think that they have low cost resources, and so therefore they can win in the game of making sure that they're, you know, the producer that can still sell. And you see some of those countries making sure that their production or their natural gas is low intensity for emissions, so that they're more competitive than some other suppliers. But then you see other countries taking a different response. Take Canada, for example. Canada is trying to squeeze every emission it can out of the rest of the economy so that all of its emissions can be focused on continuing to export, you know, oil and gas from Canada. So, you know, I think different countries are taking different approaches. My opinion is that OPEC today is just responding to the crisis it experienced in 2020 and making a benefit out of the fact that capacity was lost across the organization, right? So their ability to produce more is somewhat limited. And that really does raise the question when one, you know, kind of tries to crystal ball it, which is, you know, which of these countries do we think will continue to add capacity to produce more oil and which ones won't? And who will take up the slack if demand doesn't fall off because of technology or policy?
Okay, Amy, that's been absolutely fascinating. So really useful look at a lot of themes in energy. So thanks very much for your time. And thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully you found that useful, and hopefully you'll join us again for a future edition of the Bruin Podcast.